Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from Luminary Media and the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
For my latest Axe Files show on CNN, we did something a little different. We went to Iowa, home of the first in the nation presidential caucuses, to catch up with the candidates, activists, and especially the voters who on a snowy winter night in February will winnow down this Democratic field. What follows are portions of those conversations. One of my first stops was to see David Yepsen, an old friend and certified Iowa sage who, for more than three decades, was the lead political writer for the Des Moines Register. So I've asked this question of others, and you know this very well because you're a student of these things, but the country sort of looks at Iowa and says, who are they
right
to make this decision? So I guess my question is, to you, what is the answer to that question? Is Iowa really the filter through which these candidates should pass? And do you think there'll come a point when the national parties, decide this isn't the way to go?
It could. Every 4 years, I've heard, oh, this will be the last year Iowa's important. Iowa's important because Iowa's first. People here in Iowa have, you know, they have no market on being good Americans who are trying to do their civic duty. And I don't think Iowa ought to be so parochial as to say, geez, if there's a better way we can pick our presidents, we ought to
But they
get
do seem
it.
To take it very seriously.
They do, and particularly this year. I mean, they've been told they're important so long, they've come to believe it. And the real front runner in Iowa right now is undecided, and that will still be true 2 weeks before the caucuses. Caucus goers understand gaffes occur, things blow up in campaigns, and they might have a preference, and then they have to be undecided for a while they rethink the field. Iowa's important because Iowa's first, and Iowa's important because the country can't agree on an alternative.
Bernie Sanders knows Iowa well. In 2016, he lost the caucuses by a hair to Hillary Clinton, but left with the momentum of an upstart challenger turned serious contender.
I am a big fan of the Iowa caucus process. And what impresses me, David, is I think the people of Iowa understand the oversized role they play in the American political process, and they take it seriously. So I suspect there are many, many thousands of people who will go to my rallies and events, will go to other candidates' rallies, and really size up the candidates, think about the issues, and try to decide which candidate best reflects their views. That's pretty impressive. You know, in a time when so many people are disillusioned and giving up on politics, the people of Iowa deserve a lot of credit for being actively involved in the political process.
For Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg, the caucuses are new, but they know that to advance, they have to survive the vetting process that is Iowa.
They've made me a better candidate from the first visit that I was here, because people do take it seriously. They show up, and they show up because they care. They show up because they know they're invested in the outcome. And they show up prepared to challenge, prepared to listen, prepared to talk. And, this is the best of our democracy when that happens, right?
Well, it's got its own energy, it's got its own culture and style, but what I love about it is it's friendly, it's nice. Don't get me wrong, it's a vigorous and fierce competition, but people expect you, and by the way, your supporters, to interact well with each other, and I think there's a kind of ethic about it that I appreciate. You can tell that the Iowa voters, caucus goers, really take their role seriously as a kind of vetting committee. Because they're out in front, you can sense that. There's just a kind of spirit to the whole thing that I think really does bring us down to earth, off of the TV airwaves, out of the national picture, and into a room with a bunch of other fired up Democrats wanting to see where the future's going to be.
Inquiring Democrats, you see them
sometimes three and four and five times.
Oh, yeah.
These people are not going to sign on the dotted line.
No, I'm talking to a lot of people. They say, I think you're fantastic. You're in my top four. Yeah. And I guess that's what you get for being in a field of 25. Or
yeah, top four is pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I'll take it. But they're not going to give that vote out easily. They really want to weigh and poke and prod your ideas and I think your character. And really get to know you. But I think that's part of the value of the system, the process, as quirky as it is, that requires you to convince people at a much more intimate level.
Iowa's not just a contest of candidates and ideas. It's very much a test of organization. I was joined on my trip back by Paul Tews, an old Iowa caucus hand who built the campaign here in 2007 and early 2008 that would launch Barack Obama to the presidency. One of the first calls that we made when Barack Obama was running for president was to Paul Tews. He had run the Iowa for Al Gore in 2000, and we knew we needed to win the Iowa caucuses. We wanted the best person to organize the kind of campaign, grassroots campaign, that we envisioned. Paul Tews was the kind of inspirational leader, the Sherpa, that we needed to win the Iowa caucuses.
It's a different animal because you're asking people, you know, a primary or an election for that matter is a closed ballot. You know, people go into a voting booth or vote from home, and you don't need to tell people who you're voting for. It's a very silent thing. A caucus is a public thing. You know, you go to a meeting in your neighborhood, you stand up, you have to, in front of your friends, in front of your neighbors, declare who you're for. It's an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on the size, so it's a big commitment for people.
Emily Parcell, a lifelong Iowan, was Obama's political director during the caucus campaign of 2007 and 2008. Now she is Elizabeth Warren's senior advisor, bringing to bear the deep organizing techniques that help propel Obama forward.
So everywhere I go, I say, who has the best organization out there? And to a person, whether I'm talking to reporters, activists, caucus attendees, and so on, they say, well, Warren, unhesitatingly, they say she has a kick-ass, can I say that on TV? A kick-ass organization. What are you guys doing out there that is so impressing people?
Well, we got here early. I've had a lot of people ask, when did you make the decision that you were going to make a claim in Iowa? It was not even a conversation. It was like day one, before even day one, what's the Iowa plan? How many people do you need? It was a strategic decision that I don't even really feel like was a decision. It was sort of a vision that was already there from the beginning. And so we got in early. You know, in my experience doing the Iowa caucus, you need to be here for a year. You have to have people, one, open to your candidate. You have to be willing to have the conversations with them, not expect they're going to jump to support immediately. It's going to take time. Yes, it's an investment in the Iowa caucus and winning there and starting that domino effect and rolling through this like very brutal nomination calendar. But it's an investment in passing an agenda for the United States that is going to have to come from the grassroots. And so that takes time to build. You can't do that overnight.
Well, in this building of community, it doesn't just entail talking to people about Elizabeth Warren.
Right. It's relationship building. And that's part of it, again, goes back to the ethos of we're all in this together. And we have to find ways to find common ground with our neighbors who may not agree with us on every issue, with politicians that we may not agree with on every issue. But you have to find some way to pull together and do this thing that feels really hard. And I think that's part of the leadership that the senator's providing and the tactics that are filtering all the way down to the field is this community building. And you get in, you know, we have that. We have one of our organizers runs a community garden. One of our organizers runs a 5K most weekends, and people run with her. And it's not always transactional. It's not always about the politics. It's just like bringing people together and reminding us, like, community is where this country really gets the hard work done and the best work done. And that's, whether we are successful in this or not, that is a piece of the puzzle that we really are proud of and that we want to leave behind.
The targets of all that organizing, 250,000 or so Iowans, will make a fateful decision in February that will shape the election of 2020. So I sat down with eight of them, to see what they're thinking about the race and their role in it.
Steve Logsdon from Des Moines, Iowa.
Sarah Bolton from Des Moines also.
Jeremy Anger from Newton, Iowa.
Okay, I'm Lori Hunt, and I'm from Des Moines.
Janina Messerly, and I'm from Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Karina Keene, and I'm from Ankeny.
Tim Gannon from Mingo, Iowa.
And Kanika Mays from Des Moines, Iowa.
So it strikes me that at least from now to February, I'm sitting with some of the most powerful people in America. Because right? You guys are going to decide, you know, who lives in this race and who doesn't, who moves forward and who doesn't of these 24 candidates who are running for president. And I guess my first question is, how seriously do you take that role of sorting through these candidates for the rest of the country?
Very seriously. I do. I'm a political junkie, so that's why I decided to stay in Iowa. You know, it's a nice front row seat to everything, and you meet a lot of great people coming in. A lot of good friends, and you know, and
you not only meet friends, you meet candidates.
Yeah.
Like, the place is lousy with candidates, right? They're all over the place.
But I think beyond just this group of people, people ask me, well, why is so-and-so only at 2% or 3% right now, given advantages that they think they may have? And I said, Iowans do take this seriously. They want to meet people. They want to ask questions. They want to find out, do we think this person has the ability to be the president of the United States of America?
And have you all met some of the candidates already?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Everybody, huh? Mm-hmm. And how frequent an occurrence is that? I mean, do you go and seek meetings out where the candidates are coming?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's almost weekly. At this point, it's almost weekly. I mean, I could be busy three nights a week.
Mm-hmm. Or
if
more.
Or more, quite frankly.
This week, daily.
Yeah, at this point, honestly.
What is it? You don't even have to pay.
No.
Cheap entertainment. Do you feel like you actually get to know these candidates? I think it's so interesting because, you know, we think about presidential races in this big, vast country, and the people who are running to most of the country are figures they see on television. Mm-hmm. But when you run in Iowa in the caucuses, it's like you're running for a local office. You relate to people in that way.
Exactly.
Well, I think it depends on what the venue is. If they're giving a big speech, you don't feel like you really get to know them. But I love the smaller venues. They will talk a little bit, and then you can ask questions and then go up and talk to them afterwards, too.
So tell me some of the impressions. What are the most memorable things that you've encountered so far in running across these candidates?
Well, I'm a supporter of Beto O'Rourke, so I've seen him about four times. And the funny thing was, when he was at the Capitol for the Gay Pride weekend, I saw him and he got done speaking, and I just walked right up to him and talked to him and talked to his wife, and they were just as nice as can be. But you can do that with a lot of the candidates.
Now, were you a supporter of his from the beginning, or was it a process for you before you said, yeah, that's the person I want to be for?
Well, I think it started when he talked about kneeling for the national anthem. Mm-hmm. I thought
he was running for the Senate.
Yes, and he was just a breath of fresh air, and just have really read everything I can about him, positive and negative, to see if he's the real deal. So the last person I supported was John Edwards, and I was a delegate for him, and we see how that worked out. So won't be fooled again. So I'm just trying to learn everything.
I wouldn't hold yourself personally responsible here.
I hear you.
And are there other people who have made a firm decision already?
I think for me, pretty close. I think for Iowa, it's like a top four, or top five. But I do have a Castro or a Warren. Yeah, those are my top two.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. Warren for me.
Yeah.
And I never really liked her that much. You know, I was always for somebody else, you know, Kamala or even Joe Biden. And I think his time was 4 years ago. You know, he's kind of faulting a little bit. He's not as strong as he used to be. But I like Warren because she's going to red states and talking about things where other candidates aren't. And she's a smart woman. She's got great policy. You know, I don't agree with all the policies Democrats are coming out with, like free education and things like that. It just doesn't work. But I think she's a solid, and she's running a great campaign, in my opinion.
Have you been in a room with her?
No. Mm-hmm. No.
Okay, well, what about some of the, you say you're down to two.
Yeah.
Why?
For me, Warren, her policy plans, for sure. I definitely agree.
Which of them, which policies are the ones that most appeal to you?
Yeah, Medicare or bust, for sure. My sister has type 1 diabetes, and not everyone knows, but you need to have insulin for every carb that you intake, and it's something that is genetic when you get as a child. So without access to insulin, my sister would not be around. She is 17 years old. Mm. My father died of adenoid cystic carcinoma, and we had to go to the Mayo Clinic to get radiation treatments. And for every doctor's appointment, it was a trip to the Mayo Clinic, and that was from the Fort Dodge area.
That's a lot. So hard. Mm-hmm. What about some of the others of you?
I'm newly taking a look at the candidates, so I don't have it narrowed down to two. I would
No, you don't have to either. You got plenty
right.
of time.
Oh, most definitely. So I'm just excited to get to know the candidates, and when I am able to attend some of the meetings, I'm excited about doing that. But I would say Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, specifically because of the maternal health crisis. I'm currently studying to become a doula. Like a midwife, and I know that the maternal health crisis is important to her, and that is you know, something that I'm passionate about. And Cory Booker, I just missed when he was here. I didn't get to meet with him.
I guess he'll be back.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. So I'm just going through, taking a look at their policy plans, and you know, seeing where I can get to work at this time around.
Janina talked about a specific issues in her life that Elizabeth Warren was speaking to. I guess one of my questions for all of you is, how are you thinking about this choice? Are you thinking about it more in terms of specific issues that candidates are putting forward? Or are you looking at these candidates and saying, who would be the strongest candidate in the fall against President Trump?
I guess I would be thinking about it in terms of who's going to be the strongest against Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite frankly, somebody who sounds good to me but is not appealing to the masses is not going to be amenable to the country at large. As a result, you know, Pete Buttigieg is the guy who's interesting to me. He's young, yes, but puts across specific policy proposals that are articulate, and you know, people in the part of the country that I live can understand. You know, for me, you have to balance what do you want in a person versus what is appealing in the broad spectrum. And we're only looking at 80,000 votes in the upper Midwest, quite frankly. And I think Pete Buttigieg does a good job of hitting those people that are enough to turn 270 electoral votes toward the Democrat.
And have you met him?
I've not met him, actually. Mm-hmm.
So you're mostly just judging from the coverage of him, what?
Yeah, reading, talking to his campaign operatives, kind of in my area.
So this is interesting. How many of you have been contacted by operatives for for the campaigns, for organizers, for
like daily.
Multiple times
while we were
just
yeah.
That's the good thing about committing to someone is then you can say I'm with
somebody.
But I just wanted to follow
Although,
up.
You know, you always people are always looking for you for their second choice.
Maybe their second, third. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, well, you were going
to
say.
Well, I was going to say yes. We need someone to get Trump out of office, but that's not enough. I mean, we need someone who's inspiring. That we agree with, who can reach across the aisle. With all the problems we have, it won't be solved by half of the Democratic Party, or half the country and just the Democratic Party. So that's what I like about Beto O'Rourke, is half of a million Republicans in Texas voted for him, mm-hmm. voted for a Republican governor as well.
Yeah, and I think also, like, it's not just like who can beat him, but who has like that personality and those qualities that are lacking right now against mm-hmm. him, you know, yes. like, empathy and character, and honesty, you know, compassionate, and all of those things that we need someone to kind of take the mantle up and to return the presidency to a place of honor.
Yes.
That's what we really need.
And how do you measure that?
That's a good question. That's Words in action.
I mean, is that something that comes across in your, you guys say you could go three, four nights a week and see candidates? Is that what you're looking for?
You can just kind of feel it. Sometimes, like, the more you talk, and, like, I saw Mayor Pete at a rally or whatever, and he got heckled, you know, by someone.
I was there, I remember that.
You know, and the way that he carried himself and, you know, the way he handled it, it's like, that's amazing. And that's exactly the type of leader that we need, you know. And I see that in a lot of the candidates that are coming through, you know, this that grace and professionalism, and, you know, and the ability to listen, and to, you know, kind of, you can take them aside and tell them a story, and you can see that the wheels kind of turn up here, and, like, you know, we can help you, you know, we need to do something to help you.
Yeah. Karina, I'm not sure. I don't want to dime anybody out here one way or the other, but you may be the youngest.
Definitely, I think.
In this, well, you don't have to say it like that.
I told her someday that would be a good thing.
Yeah. No, I felt so nervous because I knew I was going to be the youngest person here.
Well, I nothing to be Someone nervous has to
about. No, no. That's okay.
But how do you look at these candidates? A bunch of them are actually much older than you. Does the age of a candidate mean anything to you in deciding, or?
No, not really, not at all. Basically, what I look at, and I feel like I want to vote for young people, I guess. Like, thinking back to, like, the 2016 election, I was going to Iowa State, living in Ames at the time, surrounded by young people, and it was like Bernie Nation. And then when he didn't win the nomination, I knew so many people who didn't vote, who supported Bernie, like, hardcore. So it's like thinking about electability, and it's like thinking about millennials with low voter turnout. It's like, who are, you know, we're gonna lose if that happens again. So it's like, who are young people?
Do you think it's gonna happen again?
No.
I mean, do you see that? And you don't think so?
Oh, gosh, no. I can't.
But you're not speaking as a millennial.
Yeah, that's true.
I have two millennials, and they know more than I do. I'm very proud of this generation. They know a lot more than I did at their age.
What do you think?
About?
Whether young people are coming out this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're coming out, but definitely, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I'm going to vote, absolutely, but I don't know. It's just like the fear of, I know so many people and saw so many people in 2016 my age not vote at all because they were disappointed that Bernie didn't receive the nomination. And that's just like, I mean, I don't agree with that mentality. I don't think it's right, but I think that I
saw. Did you support him back then?
Yeah. And then when he didn't win the nomination, I got right behind Hillary because I knew I had to.
And are you supporting him now?
Yes.
I see. And that's, you've made your decision. You think that...
No, not 100%. I mean, obviously not until, I caucus in February. I'm open. I watch the debates. And, I mean, if somebody else sticks out or I feel particularly passionate about a different candidate, I mean, I'm not, I would change my mind.
Tim, what are you? You're a farmer. Yeah. I'm wondering, there are candidates who have more rural ties. I was talking to Governor Bullock today as an example, and who tout that. Is that appealing to you? Is that something that you factor into your thinking?
Absolutely. I think one of the big takeaways from 2016 for me was watching the map in Iowa, our 99 counties go from 50-some counties voted for Obama in 2008 to 30-some, 40 maybe voted for Obama in 2012 to just 6 counties voting for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And we came back a little bit in 2018 at the top of the ticket, doing a little better, but we still did much worse in rural Iowa outside the urban and suburban areas. And for us to win back our state legislature, for us to win statewide in Iowa, and I think for us to win 270 electoral votes, Democratic candidate for president has to do better in the rural parts of Iowa, the rural parts of Wisconsin, the rural parts of Michigan. It's been very heartening to me to hear Governor Bullock talk about the importance of doing better in rural America, but also to see the plans that Senator Warren and Senator Klobuchar and Senator Gillibrand all put out yesterday. Vice President Biden put out a rural and ag policy a couple weeks ago. And to be frank and honest, Donald Trump hasn't been good for rural America. You know, we've seen the trade war that's hurt farm income. We've seen the implementation of the renewable fuel standard favoring oil companies and oil refineries over biofuels producers and farmers. All that has taken money out of farmers' pockets, taken money out of Iowa's economy. And we don't have a lot of people left to lose in rural America because we've lost so much population there already.
And yet he continues to have real strength, political strength, in rural Iowa and elsewhere. Why?
Well, for one thing, we don't know who the other candidate in November of 2020 will be, so a lot of folks don't know who what their choice is going to be. And so that's why I think it's important for candidates right now to be out talking about the issues that impact not just agriculture, that's a piece of it, but you go out to rural Iowa, and if there's a hospital in that town, they're probably worried about it.
Absolutely.
And its future. And so when Congress is talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act, you look at those states that didn't implement Medicaid expansion, they all have lost rural hospitals. Fortunately, in Iowa, we haven't had that situation befall us. But if the Affordable Care Act went away because of a change in the Congress and the continued efforts by the Trump administration, that would be devastating for health care delivery in rural Iowa. And if you can't get basic health care service, your family had to go to the Mayo Clinic. And thankfully for Iowa, we have like the Mayo Clinic and the University Hospital in Iowa City. You know, we can get some of that specialized services, but, OBGYN and maternity care and emergency room service, the farther and farther folks have to go for those things, the more likely there might be poor outcomes.
Absolutely, and that kind of ties in with the maternal health care crisis, too. And I've done a lot with Planned Parenthood now, too, and now with the defunding and slashing back on Title X, that is extremely dangerous and scary, and you shouldn't have to drive 100 miles in the state to go see a doctor.
So what are the things that you hear most when you go to these events? What are the questions most about?
Healthcare is just a universal thing that everyone deals with, and with the aging population, it's something that's, even if you have insurance, there's no guarantee you won't be financially ruined by a major illness.
It's interesting because if you look at polls, cost is really, that's the runaway concern that people express about healthcare. The debate seems to be, and they're related, of course, about coverage and how we cover, how we get to universal coverage. But as you point out, there are people who are being covered now who still have very, very burdensome costs.
Well, I had a patient today, I'm a dental hygienist, but updating her health history, she said I needed this medication for my lungs to treat the inflammation. It was $400, so I called and asked for something different, and they phoned in something different, and that was $600 a month just for one of her medications. And how can people live that way?
So, Steve, you're still waters run deep. I know you're thinking about you because you mentioned earlier that you don't agree with all of these nostrums, all of these plans that are out there. One of the big flare points has been: should there be, as Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have suggested, a Medicare for all system that would eliminate the private insurance industry. I sense, but I may be wrong, that
to me, I'm not sure about that. That always weighs out. It depends on who's in Congress, and healthcare is always very, very tricky. Some of the things that they have brought out, like Bernie has really talked about free education for people, and I think Elizabeth Warren kind of came out and said free college. I don't agree with that. There are some things that I like about them, but overall, these are kind of unrealistic things. In a state, in Iowa, I'm Democrat, but we're very moderate about things. Mm-hmm. I paid for my education. So, people, they get free education. What else do they want free? That's not the way the society works. It's not the way the culture works,
I think when we're talking about these plans and for me, Medicare for all means that we're not saying that you need if you have a certain amount of money, you deserve to live over somebody else. So I think there really isn't, I can't quantify it. It has to be possible. I mean, I know that it's possible that every American deserves the right to live, no matter how much money they make. And as far as free education, that helps our society. How many more jobs can we create if people are more educated in certain fields? How many more jobs can we create to counteract whatever the expense is?
And that would be wonderful, but it has to be paid for. And I guess with the Medicare for All, you know, to force, it's kind of the better the devil you know than devil you don't. People have chipped, they've chipped away at Obamacare, and I'm afraid if we push Medicare for All in, they're just going to chip away at that too.
And I agree because
$400 a pill. So but there's
to have the option. I think people are scared to change without knowing. And hopefully, if Medicare for All is as good as we hope it would be, they will go from private insurance to that. But I think it's better to have this transition in the hopes that we will all get there eventually. But it's so drastic for people, and it's healthcare affects all of us. So,
I mean, look inside the state. We've changed from a Medicaid delivery system to an MCO system, and it hasn't worked out particularly well. Piecemeal change is okay. It might not be the change you want right now, but it is the change you want in time. And I'm okay with piecemeal change. I'm 37. I'm not against Medicare for All. However, it's okay to take baby steps that direction. Mm-hmm. People in Iowa are not prepared to make drastic changes on any president's whim, on any president's signature.
I agree.
We can get there, but we've got to get there in steps.
Yeah, it's interesting to me though, because you said that you know, you're impressed by Elizabeth Warren, and you know she's driving around in a bus that says "honk if you believe in big structural change." And that kind of flies in the face of what you just said. So there must be something about her personal qualities or her presentation.
You know, everybody has different issues. You know, it might be healthcare, it might be whatever, you know, certain thing that they want to change. But the bottom line is we're here to find a way to beat our president now. So to be so extreme with doing these things doesn't really help to beat this guy. You know, when you talk about healthcare, which I'm all for, but it's going to take a long time in this the way the Congress works. Healthcare is a tricky, tricky thing. Mm-hmm. But why not find ways? You know, if you want to, you know, free education for everybody, well, why not do something where, when I went to college, my interest rate was fucking astronomical, and I finally paid it off about 10 years ago. Well, why not make it easier for interest rates to be easier for people to go to college? You know, right now, what I see in our society is people can't stay off their phones. How are they going to get through college? So we're going to give it to them free, and then the next thing you know, what else do they want for free?
I mean, I can refi my mortgage, but I can't refi my student loans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It used to be at the University of Iowa 20-ish years ago, mm-hmm. you could pay for a semester of tuition, maybe not books and living expenses, but you could pay for a semester of tuition with a work-study job. And you can't do that anymore.
You can't do that anymore.
Kareena, you're still in school?
Yeah, I'm a student.
Yeah, and how are you? How much of an issue for this is for you? Is this issue of student loans costs?
It's pretty big, I guess. I still have 2 years left before I'm finished with school, and I mean, I agree with what Steve said about how it does seem a little bit unrealistic to give free public education to everybody. But at the same time, it's like there is no, for me at least, there's no alternative to not going to school. Like if I chose to not obtain a degree because I couldn't get the funding to do so, what kind of life would I have? Am I supposed to survive off of $7.25, like a minimum wage job? Like, it's not possible. But I would be a bigger proponent of like student loan debt cancellation. And yeah, if you can refinance your house, you should be able to refinance your student loan debt. I mean, definitely, I think that's something. Free college, as wonderful as that would be, I don't know how realistic it is and what that would look like.
Janina, I heard you described your family's medical situations and I kind of was watching you when Jeremy and Steve were talking about
expressive.
Taking incremental steps, baby steps. You don't, you're not a proponent of the smaller steps.
So I guess I would first like to say we learned a lot of lessons in 2016 when you were like, is this going to happen again? Will Trump be reelected? We all shook our heads no. So I think for Iowans, we really have to see what is going to be best for the future of America. If we're really going to take the caucuses seriously, we should be really thinking outside of ourselves and outside of our homes. For me, I believe that, first of all, I was the first Latina to graduate high school in my immediate family. I'm the only one with a bachelor's degree. And I started at a community college with a Pell Grant. And that's the only reason I'm an intelligent person. I got accepted into a number of four-year universities that I could not afford, absolutely could not afford. I went on to teach developmental writing at my community college. And I was a tutor for a time. And I think it's really heartbreaking to see students, 18-year-olds out of high school, that can barely read. There's no way, there's hardly any jobs that you can get without that. So there is structural changes that need to happen in our educational system. But also we need to make sure that college is obtainable and technical degrees are highlighted. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that it should not cost so much money to obtain an education. And free, I think Elizabeth Warren's plan is that if you your family income is below a certain amount, then it's free, and then the rest of Americans pay their way. Mm-hmm.
You're paying very close attention to the detail.
I love it. I speaking about the technical school, because I have gone through cosmetology school and recently massage therapy, I would almost want to, or any young person that I'm able to have an to take some time with, I would like to encourage them about taking a vocational, technical type of schooling that maybe is not a $50,000 private school education. And get back to encouraging young people to open up their own businesses. I came from, you know, entrepreneurs. My grandmother was a hairstylist here in Des Moines for 55 years, and her cosmetology license is 1945, so she did hair my whole life. And then my mother right behind her was a nail tech, you know, working in salons. So I would just, and I don't have children, but I've got, you know, stepchildren that I've raised, and I'm just encouraging them to, you know, think about something vocational that would maybe be more affordable, that would maybe guarantee their income a little bit more to make their student loans so they could pay them.
Tim said that Donald Trump has been bad for rural America. I want to return to the president for a second, or more than a second, and ask you how you view this election versus other elections. Has he made this a different kind of election for you? Do you feel somehow the stakes are greater in this election than in the normal election? I know Iowans always take this process seriously. Do you think people are taking it more seriously now?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You know, they always say, like, you know, at every rally or whatever I've been to, it's always like, this is the most important election of your lifetime. It's always the same, you know, every 2 years, every 4 years it is. But I think this one is more about the heart and soul of our country. Mm-hmm. And it's about our status in the world, and it's about the direction that we need to take. And there is going to be a clear choice of which way to go.
Yeah. You know? So I need to ask you this. The last four nominees of the Dems, this is how important you people are. The last four nominees of the Democratic Party all won the Iowa caucuses. Yep. It was the gateway through which they had to pass. I worked for Barack Obama. He would not have been president of the United States but for the Iowa caucuses. If he hadn't won here, he would not have been nominated. So there's a very good chance that the person that you choose will be the person who will face off with President Trump. How will you rate their ability to defeat the president, in your view? Or do you just assume that if someone appeals to you, that they're going to appeal to the country and they'll be electable?
I guess, you know, the current occupant of the White House is so morally adept that any Democrat would be favorable to that person. However, you still have to have a person who can beat the current occupant.
You guys almost know people who voted for Trump.
Oh, 100%. I do. I do.
How are those conversations?
They're not a fan of Trump. However, they're also not a big fan of Warren. They're also not a big fan of some of the other more progressive candidates on our ticket or who are advocating for the top of the ticket. And so I'm trying to balance my own desires and also trying to look at what can I do to bring the majority of Iowans together behind a ticket that is non-Trump.
You know, the name that hasn't come up at all here is the person who's leading the polls, and that's Vice President Biden. And one of the arguments that you hear advanced for him is that he is the guy, he's leading in the national polls against Trump. I don't hear his name here. Why?
I guess that's too old.
I don't know. I guess I see Buttigieg as a guy who's essentially who's essentially Biden just four decades younger.
Okay.
And I'm 37, and Buttigieg is essentially my age, and so maybe I see myself more in
as line. President.
Yeah, right. You know, yeah. Don't I feel great?
Might as well jump in, or everybody else is.
Help us win Jasper County. Oh, yeah.
But you know, I mean, I don't have a problem with Biden at all. Quite frankly, I just feel like if he had ran in 16, it would have been more effective. And for me, Warren and Biden, their time was 4 years ago. It's not now. And so I'm looking for a new candidate to drive the Democratic Party in the direction that I still want to see it go. I want to see somebody drive the country forward. And kind of like Obama, still, I mean, in the wake of Dayton and El Paso, we still had a person who could speak presidential in the face of somebody who spoke with such, you know, hubris and, you know,
eloquence.
Yeah, he was just so different. He gave us such a different path and gave us a place to imagine where the presidency could go versus where it has currently gone. And for me, Buttigieg can still do that.
You know, he would be the first openly gay president. Would that be an impediment for your neighbors?
You know what? 20 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe it would have. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so in 2019. People have a gay cousin. People have a gay uncle. It's not a big deal. Like, we're past that point. We've turned that page. We were all really quiet about it. And then 2009 came around and the Varnum decision here in Iowa. And then suddenly people were like, oh, well, I guess it's just a thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're past that.
Do you guys all agree with that?
No.
I mean, oh, yeah.
You don't?
Yes, kind of.
I'm part of the LGBTQ community, and so are you. And I feel like there are a lot of barriers to our community. I know that a lot of people like Pete Buttigieg, but I think it's despite the fact. I really do.
And you think this would be an impediment in a general election?
For me, I don't care for Pete because he does not do well with Black Americans. Mm-hmm. He's polling at maybe 2%, and in South Bend, Indiana, he was not able to get the police force together and really bring the communities together. And I think anybody, and Joe Biden as well, if you're not speaking to the minority community, you're not fit to be president.
I mentioned the vice president. You had one simple line, which was...
No, I think he's too old. You know, again, in 2016, he was a much better candidate than he is now, and especially when we watch the debates. You know, he's kind of center stage, so he's kind of the guy, patriarch of all of them. But he suffered a little bit, and you have these young guys that are coming at him and stuff, and he didn't quite react. So I'm more pragmatic on who my candidate is because I want to beat Trump. So who's the best guy that can beat him? You know, you can talk about policy, you can talk about healthcare, immigration, all that stuff. We have to have somebody that can beat him. Yeah. You have to have somebody that has bravado, smarts. And again, I was never a fan of Elizabeth Warren, but she's running, in my opinion, the best campaign. She's got great success in the Senate. She's a smart woman. And I think she would go really well against him. And she's got, in my opinion, you know, some of the policies are, I wouldn't agree with, but overall, not everybody's candidate.
Does that matter, Tim, these policies? Would that make it Jeremy says in Jasper County, I mean, he finds some resistance.
Well, I mean, I think one of the blessings we have right now is an overabundance of what could be very strong candidates. Mm-hmm. And as we started talking, we take our responsibility seriously in vetting these men and women. And hopefully out of Iowa, we'll have a handful, a dozen maybe still, that the rest of the country can then
say.
So you
feel like if you narrow it down to a solid five, you've done your job.
I don't know. I don't know what the number is, but you alluded to the fact that Barack Obama would not have been president without winning in Iowa, and that the last nominees all won Iowa. And so I think it'd be very hard for someone to win the nomination without coming out of Iowa, either winning or with some kind of momentum.
You mentioned earlier that you've all been contacted by these organizers for the campaign. Sarah, you said you're seeking refuge in your Beto place.
I'm safe in my Beto bubble.
Off your back. What are those interactions like? I'm interested. I remember the young organizers who worked for Obama, and they sort of took up residence in the communities that they were organizing. And so tell me what these contacts are like. And do you, at some point, do you feel like saying, hey, leave me alone, or I'm going to get a different number,
I leave it open.
I have a conversation with them.
I'm a high school teacher and a college professor, and it's fun to see them excited. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, I mean, I would, like, my heart of hearts is, it just tells me, like, let them do what they want. I mean, they're encouraged, they feel optimistic, whether it's my candidate or not. I don't particularly care, because in my heart, I'm a teacher, and they're excited about a candidate. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing.
Right.
And I mean, whether it's Republican or Democrat, you feel inspired. And the sense of civic optimism in this country wanes precipitously. And so to see a bunch of 21 and 22, mm-hmm. 20-year-olds excited about politics and really trying to put the sell on me, mm-hmm. it's kind of exciting, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, go for it. Like, I don't support your candidate at all, but
good for
let's
you.
Do it. Let's, yeah.
I'm sure they'll good be glad you. To hear that.
Yeah, you know.
So do you, and these conversations are ongoing, so they keep checking back with
oh,
you?
Oh, they do, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Email, text.
I've actually had four campaign staffers or volunteers living with me. I had one that left today who's from Atlanta.
From different campaigns?
All from Beto. Uh-huh. But they are young, and they're very inspiring. And whenever I get a text from Bernie or Buttigieg, I tell them I'm supporting Beto, but good luck and much respect to your candidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of like going to an ice cream store with these Democratic caucuses and all that. I mean, as long as I come out with ice cream, I may not get the exact kind I want, but I'm still going to be happy.
For sure, a lot of flavors.
There are a lot of flavors, but they're all good.
So
they're all good.
The caucuses themselves, I think people don't really appreciate what that experience is like, because, you know, most of America, we go, we spend 5 minutes in a polling place, we draw the curtain, we vote for whoever we want to vote for. Nobody knows who we voted for. And then we leave. This is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You have to stand up in front of your neighbors.
You do.
Declare your intentions.
Not like Republicans who do it by secret ballot.
Right. Yes. I mean, you're talking about getting a bunch of people out in the middle of winter to stand up and publicly say, I support this candidate or I support this one. And then if they don't have viability, you got to jockey around. And we had people there from all over the world watching us go on for 3.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's commitment. You've got to want it. Mm-hmm.
But it is an honor to be first in the nation.
Let me ask you that about that, because in other places, there's a lot of grousing about you guys. It's like, why should 200,000 or 150,000 or whatever it is, people in Iowa get to make this momentous decision? You know, what makes you, who anointed you guys?
Well, they say that, but they're not getting the 5 mailers a day, the 10 phone calls a day, the texts, the this, the that. Sounds great from the outside, but it is August and we are bombarded. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah.
Retail politics is a lot easier in Iowa, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, fundamentally.
I think it's cheaper.
It's hard to reach people in bigger states.
But, you know, this is a state, it's overwhelmingly white.
It is.
It's a rural state, although obviously Des Moines is a substantial city, and there are other cities in the state or towns in the state. The argument is not really reflective of the country as a whole. Is that a fair criticism?
No. I think Iowa is kind of special. It's kind of like a microcosm of stuff, because you can kind of, you know, you can stay here in Des Moines and talk like rural issue, you know, or like urban issues, like within the city, and you know, with immigrant issues, you know, and then take a drive out for an hour, you're in Jasper County, and you're talking like rural, you know, rural issues and agriculture and stuff. So I think there's a lot that Iowa has to offer, you know.
We may be underrepresented as far as minorities, but you can see having Obama elected twice. I think there's a common sense and a everyman quality here. Plus, we're nice and we're not rude to people who come to our door trying.
You are nice.
We are nice.
Yeah. That is true. Janina, you.
Well, I just don't believe that it's fair to say that a majority white area could speak for minority communities, and I really I respect you too, but I just don't think that it's fair to say that you can speak and discuss and have conversations about immigrant issues and then really know what immigrants go through on a day-to-day basis and undocumented people.
But we can also be compassionate about that and be advocates.
I think people in Iowa are pretty smart about it.
You can be compassionate, but you
don't. I haven't walked in your shoes, though, of course. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
So I just don't understand why the votes of a majority white, you're compassionate so you know how to vote for the minority communities.
I know how to educate myself about issues and be compassionate about people who aren't like myself and try and advocate for them, whether it's immigrants or minorities.
So let's advocate for another state that is a little bit more diverse. I think
that
is.
Do you see your role in these caucuses as representing those perspectives?
Absolutely. I am a community organizer for an organization, it's a nonprofit called the Latino Political Network, and I do most of my work in areas of Iowa where it's a 50% Latinx population. And within those areas of Iowa, it is very difficult to elect Latinos to school board and city council, and I just don't think it's fair when the majority of the kids in school are Latino and everybody on the school board is Anglo and white and not bilingual, and those are that's very important. It's just fundamentally important.
Yeah.
That may change over time.
Talk about gerrymandering.
Well, there's
too.
Only 23
in different states.
But just back to what you were saying, Dave, I think what you're saying is that we're not represented, and that's
right.
And it's every day. I mean, I walk it every day. You know, we just had an implicit bias meeting at my spa where we work, and just in coming out to a waiting area, greeting a guest, and what are your thoughts, or the guests, what are their thoughts when they see me? I've had people pause when they see me come out, and they're like, "Oh, okay." You know, clearly did not know that they were maybe going to be serviced by an African-American woman today. And I see it. I've seen it my whole career where I see the pause and I know what it means. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is something right. that you like to hear where the candidates stand on minority issues altogether. And then we can have the conversations with mm-hmm. our, you know, neighbors and friends right. and coworkers mm-hmm. So that they completely can understand it. Know you're can't walk in our shoes, but you can understand it a little better how when we're walking this out every day, I have a t-shirt that says, "Yes, there are black people in Iowa." My friend makes these shirts, and because it is a thing, and I do want to see that, I see a change happen with that. I do want to see healing. I do want to see reconciliation with minorities and with immigrants, mm-hmm. and I do want to see that. So that.
And do you think candidates are speaking to that?
I think some candidates are. The candidates that I stand for. And I would also like to say that Iowa has a large incarceration rate for Black and Latinos, mm-hmm. For disproportionately. So we're not doing well on policies here right now. So I'm just not quite sure if everybody understands what to look for in presidential candidates.
Well, we need more people like you.
to run for office.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Once I elect way more people.
I'll go slip in my numbers.
I don't know. You may. You, it looks to me like you may not yet qualify for the presidential race.
No. Not even a governor.
There are many other races.
Well, I imagine that you guys are going to spend many hours communing with candidates, organizers, mm-hmm. thinking about this between now and the end. And I am impressed by the seriousness with which people in this state take that obligation. And I suspect there'll be a lot of twists and turns in the road between now and then. I mean, we're just at the state fair. We haven't gone through the steak fry, I guess it used to be called the JJ dinner, not any longer, but there are a lot of events along the way, debates, impromptu things that happen that test people. You guys will be watching all of that.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yes.
So great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, all right, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for listening. We're going to take the Labor Day week off, and we'll be back on the 9th of September with a second volume of my past interviews with some of the candidates who will be on the debate stage later that week. So please join us then.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, presented by Luminary Media and the University of Chicago Institute of Politics. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Aaron Buckner, Samantha Neal, Katie O'Brien, and Allison Siegel. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.